May it please the court, Ms. Justin. Good morning. Again, I'm Cheryl Walker on behalf of the informant, the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel. And this case involves issues of competence, diligence, communication, dishonesty, misrepresentation, fraud, deceit, conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, and providing financial assistance to a client. There are two complainants in this case. The first, Charles Rogers, retained the respondent in July of 2006 to represent him in a suit against Bank of America relating to erroneous debits from his account. Though respondent told Mr. Rogers that a petition had been filed against the bank in 2007, that the petition against the bank was not filed until 2009, nearly 3 years after Mr. Rogers first retained respondent, and nearly 1 year after respondent had informed Mr. Rogers that the case had in fact been settled for $75,000, and more than 5 months after Mr. Rogers filed the complaint that brings us here today. In addition, the respondent loaned Mr. Rogers $1,000 of his personal funds while the litigation was contemplated, and though he had told Mr. Rogers that it was pending. The second complainant, Robert Gerger, retained respondent in November 2005 to represent him in a post-conviction relief matter. Mr. Gerger paid him a total of $5,500 for his services, and the respondent provided Mr. Gerger with a copy of a motion to recall mandate and told the Mr. Gerger that in November of 2006 that the motion was successful and that the matter had been remanded to circuit court for final disposition, but the respondent never filed the motion. The informant and respondent entered into a joint stipulation of facts and conclusions of law, and the disciplinary hearing panel adopted the joint stipulation as its decision, and contrary to the respondent's assertion in its brief, the panel's decision specifically provides that it, quote, adopts the facts, conclusions, and recommendations set forth in the stipulation. As a result of adopting the stipulation, the panel properly concluded that the respondent committed professional misconduct by failing to provide competent representation to the complainants, by failing to act with reasonable diligence with respect to their matters, and by failing to adequately communicate with Mr. Gerger that a motion had little or no chance of success under the present state of the law, and providing financial assistance to Mr. Rogers, and further engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, and engaging in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice.
What is recommended discipline?
The recommended discipline was to suspend the respondent with the suspension stayed and probation to last for 1 year.
Why? Why would you stay and give probation? He clearly lied. He clearly deceived his client. He clearly misrepresented the. This is a case where the client has been and the system has been abused by a lawyer who had no qualms about flaunting the ethical system as it is. Why would you stay suspension?
Yes, sir. In reaching that decision, we looked at both the ABA standards, which this court has relied upon, and in addition to that, we paid particular attention to the case of N. Ray Wiles. With regard to the ABA standards, we clearly concluded that the conduct warranted suspension. So that was not difficult for us to reach that decision. But then we looked at whether there were aggravating and mitigating circumstances with regard to his conduct. And for example, with regard to the aggravating circumstances, we certainly found the fraud and dishonesty to be among them, and substantial experience in the practice of law to be among them as well. And, you know, I might even add now, though this wasn't alleged in our brief, but after reading the respondent's brief, that another aggravating circumstance would be the failure to acknowledge the severity and to take responsibility for the conduct. But we then looked at mitigating factors, and the mitigating factors in this case were his public service, the reputation in the legal community, and the lack of any recent disciplinary.
But how do you mitigate lying?
Yes, he did not mitigate lying. I guess that we looked at it in the context of his cooperation with the Office of Disciplinary and as well as N. Ray Wiles was a case where the facts were somewhat similar in the context of dishonesty and fraud were alleged, conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, and there had been prior admonitions, I think 11 in that case. And whereas in Mr. Fleming's case, there were 3 prior admonitions, but unlike the Wiles case, he was not accused of any violations regarding the safekeeping of people's property or clients' property, and that was what led us to the result that we thought it was within the same range as Wiles, because Wiles was
the other aspect of the judgment call of saying, I got a $75,000 settlement. There's other ways that maybe you'd expect your client to say, so where's my money? I mean, at some point, someone's going to say, where's my money on the $75,000 settlement that was never settled?
Correct. And that did happen. And as a matter of fact, according to the respondent, Mr. Rogers, that he received various phone calls from Mr. Fleming, or he placed various phone calls to Mr. Fleming and was told that his settlement money was forthcoming and had him actually to come to his office on at least 3 separate occasions to receive the $75,000 check less the legal fees.
Does he have a drinking problem? Did he allege a drinking problem, a mental health problem, or any other factor like that? I'm not sure that still relieves lying, but is anything like that, that the substance abuse problem that would cause him to violate the rules?
There was not an allegation of that. A psychiatric evaluation and a substance and alcohol abuse evaluation were among the things that were set forth and agreed upon probation to have that analyzed and looked into.
But you had there was no allegation he had those problems, or was there?
There was no allegation that he had those problems, nor in any of the responsive, interactions that we had during the process where he or his counsel alleged that that was a problem.
I mean, we rely on complaining parties to, but it doesn't mean this is not, the problem is a lawyer has so much of trust that's given to them by our court and by the bar examiners that we have a trustworthy bar, that you can trust on the fact that we have that. And it gives huge authority, I mean, huge power to lawyers to do whatever they want, and trust agreements and what he's doing here. We don't know, since it's a reporting mechanism, we don't really police it, that there aren't other people who he's lied to.
Yes, sir, you're absolutely correct. And during this case, there were various interactions once, or there was an allegation by Mr. Fleming that Mr. Rogers wanted to rescind his complaint against him, and he sent over a document to me stating that it was a rescission and that the Mr. Rogers said his girlfriend filed a complaint, but he really didn't intend to file it.
It doesn't really matter. It came to us that he lied.
We're
trying to protect the public, not just the person who brings it forward to us as a complainer. We're trying to, our goal was to protect the public from liars and cheats and people who are misrepresenting things to clients, potential clients, this is not good.
I agree. And the only reason I brought up that portion of it was because the same day that Mr. Fleming called me, Mr. Rogers called me and said he was coerced to sign that document. And so because of that, the disciplinary committee had Mr. Rogers and Mr. Gerger
appear
before the committee. He said he was told that if he signed it, that then he would get the $75,000 settlement, but as long as he, had the complaint pending, he couldn't continue with his assistance of him.
But he still gave him $2,000.
$1,000, yes, sir.
$1,000.
Yes, as a loan.
What's your response to the list of cases, including included in the respondent's brief, where they claim that those persons were engaged in similar conduct and received probation?
Well, the thing that I would say about that is that the respondent wants you to look at those cases, but, those cases were without written opinions, and that we, the informant, recognize that each case is different. Each case must stand and fall on its own set of facts and circumstances, and so we do not find that laundry list of cases instructive
whatsoever.
But do we know,
are these all cases in which there was alleged lying and so forth? I mean, what do we,
Are these comparable facts?
No, we don't. The cases was just literally a list of cases in which this court had found the discipline to be probation.
This was just alleged lying. There was stipulation that he lied. I mean, it was not. It's a proven fact, and before the court and before the public at this point, that he lied. We suspend people for felonies,
Mr.
where they have not committed any offense to a client, and yet. If we condone lying, that's a big problem.
I agree with you. Mr. Fleming alleges miscommunication. He alleges that he gave Mr. Gerger a draft of the motion, and Mr. Gerger misunderstood that the draft was actually filed.
But you had a fact-finding group, which is the...
Who concluded otherwise, correct.
And they found the facts the way they were, and that's what we're about to do.
Yes, sir.
We can reconsider all the facts here, right? It's an original proceeding in this court. We're not bound.
Yes. Yes, your review is de novo, yes.
De novo, but there was a panel committee that found facts.
Yes, the panel adopted the joint stipulation of facts and conclusions of law as its own. And what I found particularly interesting as it related to the respondent's brief was the fact that now they somehow allege that they weren't meant to be true, that they were just... you know, things that they agreed to in order to expedite the process. And I really found that disingenuous in the sense that we'd spent many months actually getting to the point.
So he signed the stipulation and it's not true because he wants to expedite the process of continuing to practice law.
Yes. Yes. They mischaracterized it and said that it was now that it wasn't meant to be truthful, but rather to, quote, avoid extended proceedings.
So it propounds the violations even more at this point.
Yes, and further, they state that what they agreed to in the stipulation should be the outer limits of discipline. And I just want this court to know that we negotiated in good faith, and the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel during those negotiations viewed the state's suspension as the
floor. So it could be another claim of misrepresentation to you about what they're signing. I mean, that's the next step.
Yes, sir.
It's a misrepresentation to the OCDC when you're proceeding in good faith that they don't really mean it.
Agreed.
So we
viewed it as the floor rather than the ceiling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
If it please the court, my name is Kate Justin. I represent Larry Fleming in this matter. Suspension is too much in this case based on the allegations. Before I address that, I just wanted to let you know why I was here. I've known Larry for quite a while. I met him when he was on the opposite side of the case. We tried cases against each other. We tried cases with each other. And I have found him to be an excellent attorney who's given no indication that he would do anything unethical.
Has he expressed any remorse to date?
The remorse he expressed is that he loaned money to a client, Mr. Rogers, and that he failed to communicate with the clients. He does not admit to lying to the clients. In fact, the evidence shows that Mr. Rogers gives inconsistent testimony in terms of what happened, as does Mr. Gerger. And so, therefore, you decide, based on what you hear and read, whether what is credible or not. Mr. Rogers gave many examples of that in his testimony in terms of what happened, that he said that this complaint was his, and then he went and signed it, and he drafted. And then the evidence shows that he told Larry that, no, wait a minute, it wasn't me, it was my girlfriend who ended up drafting it and who ended up signing it. And so Larry had him come in, they sat down, he went ahead and he memorialized what had happened. And as soon as Mr. Rogers gets out of that meeting, he calls Ms. Walker and he says, look, this isn't true. I did sign, it was my complaint, and I did sign it and I did draft it. Now, I went ahead and deposed him on April 30th, 2010. And during that deposition, I asked him questions about this, and he admitted that he told Larry that his ex-girlfriend helped him write that complaint.
Where did the $75,000 settlement come from? Out of the air?
Right, Mr. Rogers. Larry Larry never told Mr. Rogers that this case settled. He never told him that. That's just Mr. Rogers' allegations. Mr. Rogers said other things that indicated that he was being inconsistent in his testimony in terms of what happened. One of the things, we'll say phone calls. Mr. Rogers claims that Larry told him you had this $75,000 settlement. He changed the amounts through his deposition, by the way. And he said, yes, you have this $75,000 settlement, and we'll get you the money. Then Mr. Rogers testified that Larry, after he supposedly said this, called him all the time. He frequently called him. This is in the deposition, saying, you know, give him a status of that money. Now, if Larry promised somebody money and said there was a settlement when there wasn't, why would he frequently call him afterwards? And Mr. Rogers said all the phone calls after that were initiated by Larry. Here's another thing about regarding whether the settlement exists. There are no witnesses to say that this settlement existed other than Mr. Rogers' word, his ex-girlfriend who lives in Germany who helped him with his complaint. And I like this one. During a deposition, he said, well, a friend, too, is a witness to this. And I asked him about that, and he said, well, the friend was in the room and overheard Larry telling him, you have the $75,000 settlement. And I asked Mr. Rogers, I said, okay, what did you and he discuss about? Nothing. You didn't say anything to each other?
Why would you stipulate to the discipline or the stipulation with the OCDC if it was untrue?
He stipulated to the discipline. Quite frankly, I told him not to. I advised him no, because the evidence shows.
So you're covered on the previous case. Okay.
No. On this case, I said right. The evidence is in our favor. So don't do it. And he was having heart problems at the time. He's 69 years old. It was very stressful. He had huge cases. He's like, no, I only have a few more years left in my career. This is too much for me. We'll just go ahead and we'll agree to this, you know.
So did he stipulate to the fact that he had lied about the $75,000 settlement?
No, he did not.
What did he stipulate to?
He stipulated to the fact that he failed to communicate effectively with Mr. Rogers and Mr. Gerger, and he admitted to loaning Mr. Rogers money. And that's another thing about Mr. Rogers' inconsistent testimony. He initially said, in his deposition that Larry loaned him $1,000, you know, so he could go to Germany, and then he later said $500. So he wasn't even consistent in the amounts he claimed that Larry.
It doesn't matter. He did loan him money.
He did loan him money. That's what he admits he did wrong. He did loan him money, so he could go to Germany.
The stipulation with the OCDC says simply that those are the allegations
yes.
of the complainant.
That's true.
As opposed to that he admits those are true facts.
That is true. Yes, he doesn't admit to lying because he didn't lie. And I want you to know, too, there's no victims in this case. Other cases you hear before is you have victims. Mr. Rogers' lawsuit is still pending. It hasn't been dismissed. Larry didn't miss court dates. He hasn't been prejudiced anyway. His lawsuit is pending. He has a new attorney. Larry did file a lawsuit. He did discovery.
Said there was no charge to...
Pardon me?
He did not charge him?
Yes, let's talk about that. He didn't charge him. What he did for Mr. Rogers, similar to what we did for Mr. Gerger, is he had him meet with a private investigator who got facts of his case, who got him documents he needed for the lawsuit, and Larry went ahead and he did his research. He filed the complaint. He didn't charge him for filing the complaint. You know, he didn't the filing fee or the service fee. In fact, in this case, Mr. Rogers came out ahead. I hate to say that, but he did, because he admitted in his deposition that Larry did all these things for him, and he never charged him any money for expenses, for reimbursement, for the investigator time, nothing. And he came out ahead in terms of Larry loaned him this money, and he never paid it back. Mr. Gerger, by the same extent, I don't know how familiar you are with his case or not, but this is an individual who has had a problem with every single attorney he has. He told me during his deposition that one of his attorneys who basically had the original trial with, he was incompetent. It was all his fault he lost. He was incompetent. Then he had Brad Kessler do basically an appeal for him. He said he did a pathetic job too. Then Doug Hoffa, which is a public defender who also helped him with his motion, he should be disbarred because he did such a lousy job. And when he came to Larry, Mr. Gerger said he wanted to sue every one of those former attorneys for malpractice. But it turns out the statute of limitations had already run.
But Mr. Fleming, I mean, I've often had clients, people, potential clients that came to me with those same kind of complaints. I generally would stay away from them.
And he
not,
did.
I have the choice of representing someone or not representing them. So he took on representation, but...
I hear what you're saying. He went ahead and he took on somebody who wanted to sue every other attorney he's ever had. In fact, he has sued one who was prior to his criminal. And I guess Larry, you know, shouldn't have taken on a client that had such a history, but he also felt that maybe he had a chance to go ahead.
Did that come with raving a red flag in front of him, too?
Like a bull here, come get me? Yes. So, no, he shouldn't have, but he didn't take, I mean, he didn't even go into the malpractice cases. He just referred him out to another attorney. He said, you know, I don't do that. You know, and then, of course, Mr. Gerger, when he wouldn't do it, said he was guilty of collusion, you know, the colluding with the other attorneys, you know, protecting one of his own. So, and Mr. Gerger, for the money he paid Larry gave him stuff for that money, just like he did Mr. Rogers, who didn't pay. He had to meet with a private investigator. The private investigator took him to the scene of the accident where Mr. Gerger told him what happened, you know, and took pictures, came up with a report, took him to get a lie detector test done, stayed with him the entire time, got a ballistics report, which was one of Mr. Gerger's complaints with the first attorney, is he didn't get a ballistic report. So he did all these things for him, took all those voluminous documents that I'm sure you've seen, all those motions, and he reviewed them. Mr. Gerger admitted that he was pleased with Larry's research in this case. He was pleased with his opinion he wrote. He said it was beautifully written. So Mr. Gerger didn't have any complaints about that. So I just want to make sure I touch on everything here.
So what was the but then he failed to file any sort of motion?
He drafted the motion, and he let Mr. Gerger know that if the law went the way it was supposed to go, then he'd go ahead and file it. But he wasn't going to file it ahead of time because, as it stood right now, it wouldn't be granted.
So did that result
and
in
the status of the motion? It was a motion to recall mandate.
Correct. Oh, okay. And so unless the law, you know, went his way, there was no point in filing it because there was no other motion Mr. Gerger could file at that time either because the statute of limitations had run because he had filed every conceivable notion he could have after his conviction. If you look at the record, they're like this. So see, make sure, like I said, I don't want to miss anything because this is very important because his license, as you know, is on the line here, his livelihood. Larry has practiced for many years. He has an outstanding reputation in the legal community as being a lawyer who is ethical. He has gotten the highest review he can from Martindale Hubbell for, he said, 30 years in a row. These are mitigating factors, too, to take into consideration when looking at this case.
Pardon me. The list of cases that you have included in your brief in which you say are similar fact situations, they all aren't similar fact situations. I know at least one is a matter of where an attorney bought OxyContin from an undercover police officer and was disciplined, was criminally sanctioned and disciplined by us, but how do you equate that to being a similar circumstance to this situation here?
I don't, Your Honor, and it was more that these could be similar to this. They were your cases. I'm not claiming to know all the facts.
But they're different facts. They're not deceived.
No,
they're not failure to communicate. All of these are different twists. They're not on point.
That's a very valid point, Your Honor. Larry, there's no criminal actions here whatsoever. There's no scounding with you're taking away clients' money here. or misappropriating funds or breaking attorney-client privilege or anything to that degree. It's our opinion, our stance, that this is basically failure to communicate effectively with two clients who, like I said, their credibility is in question, and he did loan money to Mr. Gerger. I'm sorry, Mr. Rogers. But that, no other way do they rise, they don't rise to the level of these other cases where people have been suspended.
Is this the same Larry Fleming that stipulated to a malpractice judgment and then at the debtor's exam took the fifth and was held in contempt by the court?
Honestly, Your Honor, I don't know, because when this would have happened, I probably wasn't practicing law if you're talking, you know, about the past.
Talking about in the last 2 years.
Then that was probably Larry, though I don't want to go on record saying that, even though I guess I am, because I don't know for sure. What I do know is if you look at his career as a whole, that you will see that Larry did not do anything, you know, dishonest. He did not lie
to that happens.
Clients.
Clark Clifford was a legendary advisor to presidents and an extraordinary public citizen and patriot. But then he got involved with BCCI, and he left the profession in disgrace. That happens. I mean, you can have a great career like Clark Clifford, and then in the last few years, you can just mess it up.
Right. But given the circumstances, Your Honor, of these two people are making the allegations, taking that account of 42 years of, you know, a distinguished career, I think it's very unlikely.
If I understand your argument, you're saying the only allegation of lying or dishonesty was the allegedly telling his client that he had a $75,000 settlement, and you dispute the accuracy of that, and the rest of it, assuming that's inaccurate, is all miscommunication and matters that are subject to sanction but not suspension.
Correct, Your Honor. He never told the clients the case settled.
What if, obviously we do de novo review, and if we review the record and so find, then that would be one situation in terms of looking at discipline. What if we review the record and say, no, we think he did tell his client that? Then what's an appropriate sanction?
Right. Well, first of all, I hope you won't find that, because if you look at all these evidence, you review it, look at the inconsistencies in the testimony of Mr. Rogers and Mr. Gerger, I'm hoping you'll say what I did, no way. You know, if you do, you tell me where was the harm. Where were these two gentlemen harmed? There is no harm. So if you look into that, you can balance that with, you know, what you think that he might have done.
You're saying in the suit where he said he had a settlement, it's not being continued to be being pursued by other counsel, and there was no charge, there's no harm.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. But like I said, I think that goes against the weight of the evidence. If you review these depositions, like the two I took with the gentleman, and you review everything that's come before you, I think you'll see that that's not true at all. The only thing that he is, I guess, guilty of is failure to communicate properly and loaning a client money.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now, Ms. Walker, it seems like there's two shifts passing in the night. Your opposing party paints the defendant is a good fellow who had a couple of missteps here. I mean, her picture of the lawyer is a very good one, and yours is, it's just like, you have the last say.
Yes, sir. And a couple of things I'd like to touch on. One is with respect to remorse. There's been this constant denial, or the facts were misunderstood, and no acknowledgement for the wrongful nature of his conduct. With respect to Mr. Rogers, you know, the rules require actual or the potential to cause injury. And so I would say, for example, when Mr. Rogers appeared before the disciplinary committee, he showed us, he passed his cell phone around and showed us like six missed calls from Mr. Fleming that morning, because Mr. Fleming was to have appeared later in the day for that same hearing, but called and said he had a medical condition and could not come. And so there was evidence that the disciplinary committee Division II saw of missed calls from Mr. Fleming.
Counsel, what was the harm to the client?
The harm to, well, according to Mr. Rogers, the harm he suffered was he stated that Mr. Fleming would call him all through the hours of the night. It caused him a lot of stress. The fact that the Bank of America matter wasn't being handled was continuing to cause, I guess, continuous bounce checks and things like that.
And well, that's if there had been a good resolution, but you can't. I mean, the bounce checks would have been, there's no guarantee he would have won.
Well, correct. But as I understood
What I want to find out, did he take any money from Mr. Rogers, and is Mr. Rogers' suit being handled by someone else now?
He did not take any money from Mr. Rogers. That part is correct. And the suit is being handled by someone else.
Was there any problem with turning over the files or anything like that?
There was no file to turn over other than the draft of the motion that was never filed, that he told them had been filed. And with regard to Mr. Gerger, that Mr. Gerger's action to recall, motion to recall mandate is now time barred. So there was harm
to Mr. Gerger. Well, there is no time for filing a motion to recall mandate.
Well, as I understood it from the committee that looked at this, some of the underlying facts that related to his motion, according to others that were present, stated that they were now, because of the time had elapsed, he could not raise them. So maybe I'm using the wrong term in terms of motion to recall mandate. But
post-conviction motions have very strict and limited time periods in which they can be filed. Motions to recall mandate are not provided for in the rules, and they are, but cases do permit them to be filed at any time.
Okay. So, again, I apologize for that. Maybe that was the wrong reference.
Is it also correct, if I look at the stipulation, he didn't stipulate to the accuracy, or he didn't stipulate to the truth of the allegation?
Well, you know, your statement is a correct statement, and that was part of the difficulties that we had with him along the way, and quite frankly, in my conversations with Ms. Justin, I stated to her that you really need to make sure that your client is acknowledging something, because if he does not acknowledge his actions as it relates to these people, that we could very well end up before you today, which is where we are.
Because to be successful on probation, do you need to have some type of acknowledgement from him of the wrongfulness of his conduct?
I believe the answer is yes to that. And
has he admitted to anything, if he's only admitting to there were allegations against him? Is he admitting to any misconduct besides communication and the loan?
He's admitting to allegations against him. I would agree.
He doesn't admit to the $75,000, but does he admit to lack of communication?
He admits to telling him that the settlement range would be $75,000, but he says that he never told him that there was actually a settlement for $75,000. And if I can make one conclusion.
And you stipulated to that. Your OCDC stipulated that statement.
Yes. Yes. With regard to the years of practice, though it's a mitigating factor, it does not negate the seriousness of what brings us here today. And so I would ask that this court to do as it has consistently done in looking at matters involving dishonesty and deceit and fraud and misrepresentation and look at them for the serious nature that they are.
Are there any further questions? Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Case is taken under submission.